Okay, we have the first question from the floor. Is how does meditation help relationships? Because you all have to go home, or not all of you, and you have to live with each other. You have to be kind to each other. Number one, just as I was saying earlier, that when you get really, really nice meditation, even the contents of the toilet bowl look especially beautiful. So when you get good meditation and you go back to your partner, she looks so beautiful and he looks so handsome. He's always been like that, but because you meditated, you can appreciate things in him you've never seen before. In other words, life gets more interesting and more beautiful. And as I said in other contexts during this retreat, one of the reasons that people get upset and angry at each other, and why people who love each other say bad things, is because they are tired and stressed out. So a little bit of meditation stops all of that grumpiness and negativity in a relationship. In one of the disciples who started teaching meditation in year 6 in a school, a government run school in Perth many years ago, she did this because she noticed teaching, well, she called it quiet time because many of the students there were Christian. They called it meditation, she may have got into trouble. So she called it quiet time at the beginning of the year, these 11 or 12 year olds in year 6. In Australia. If she started with 5 minutes for the beginning of the year, built it up to about 15 minutes by the end of the school year. Every morning they would do their quiet time, a bit of meditation. And she did that because she realized it would increase her academic performance. I remember seeing the principal, and the principal said, "I'm a Christian, but this works. I've seen the amazing results in this particular class run by this particular teacher. That's why I'm supporting it. And any Christians who complain, I say, I'm a Christian too, it works, shut up, let your kid do it." But there were some interesting, unexpected results of teaching meditation to these kids. Because whenever there was an argument in the classroom, remember these were 11 or 12 year old boys and girls, whenever there was an argument about to start, invariably one of the children would put their hand up and say, "Miss, can we have quiet time now?" And so the whole class would spend 5 minutes just relaxing and letting go, watching their breath. And when they came out afterwards, all of the anger and ill will was diffused. And I try and teach that to couples. If you're about to have an argument, you know what it's like. You know, someone saying something nasty to you and you say something nasty back. Please, one of you, put up your hand and say, "Okay, quiet time." And both of you, go and sit down on your butts and meditate for 5 minutes. And then afterwards, you know, you find that reason why you're getting upset at each other is just short-circuiting. And if you don't do that, the whole family should do that. So your kids, when they see mummy and daddy arguing, the kids should put up their hand and say, "Mummy, Daddy, quiet time." And all of you have to respect that. Mummy, Daddy, the kids, sit down for 5 minutes. Only 5 minutes, that's not that long. So you don't break out into these terrible arguments. But if you do break into these arguments, it always leaves this terrible bad taste for days afterwards. No one is right. Both of you are wrong when you argue like that. But the thing is, we don't know how to break that cycle. So that's one way of doing it, having quiet time. And anyone in the family, whether it's the kids, whether it's the husband, the wife, or the dog, if you have a dog, can call for quiet time. And when they call for quiet time, everyone has to have that quiet time. Sit down, be peaceful, and you'll find a lot of the things, the real reason why you're upset, not because of your husband, because of your wife, because you're so tired, you're frustrated, you can't take it anymore. If there is something you have to discuss, some important issues, for goodness sake, choose the right time and place. Don't go and lay that on your husband when he comes home from work after a busy day stuck in the traffic. Don't tell your wife that when she's going through the worst parts of menopause. She will just get really upset. The trick is, if you've got something very serious you have to discuss, you have to choose what the Buddha said, the right time and place. And sometimes, instead of choosing that, you create the right time and place. I advise many couples, if there's something very serious you have to talk about, go out to dinner. Dress up. Go to a really nice restaurant. Not McDonald's. Your wife, your husband deserves more than that. Go out to a nice restaurant, like a nice Chinese restaurant, 9 courses. And look, by the time you get to that 9th course, your husband is so softened up. You can tell him anything, and you say, yes, darling. So soften people up, first of all. Get them in the right mood. And then you can talk about difficult issues. And they're more likely to discuss it in a good way. Simply because you have constructed the right time and the right place for that discussion. Trouble is, arguments happen when we don't choose the right time. We mention something, it's the wrong time to bring it up. Just leave it alone, let anything get cool first of all, and then you can start talking about it. And the last thing is, I mentioned this in brief in that last little talk, about people having fault-finding minds. Instead of the opposite, this is good enough. And I don't know your relationship with your partner, but sometimes that we've got such a fault-finding mind that all we see in this guy we've been living with, this woman who's been sharing our house with us for so long, that we see all her faults and all his mistakes. It's so easy to do that. That's called developing the fault-finding mind. And you young girls and boys who haven't got a partner yet, if you're looking for one, they will always have some faults. There's no girl without a pimple somewhere. There's no boy who hasn't got some fault somewhere as well. But if you have a fault-finding mind, you'll never find a partner in life at all. There's no one who is that perfect. So you girls, if you want a boyfriend, you have to remember, he's good enough. Girls, yeah, she'll do. But don't try and get the most perfect, most beautiful girl. Even the girls who appear on TV, the ones whose pictures on the front cover of the magazines, they have been airbrushed so many times. That's not real. Same with the boys in the movies. They have stunt doubles. I've seen some of those extreme things they're supposed to do in these movies. You know, these fights they have, or these motorbike chases. When they come out afterwards, their hair is perfect without one thing out of the way. There's not a bead of sweat on them. In real life, you work like that, and your hair is all over the place, sweat dripping from you, and you're a right mess. But not if you're a film star. That's all staged. So in real life, no one is really perfect. So if you've been married to someone for a long time, what do you expect? Of course they're not going to be perfect, but they're good enough. So remember, when you look at your husband, good enough. Good enough for someone to be a good friend and spend the rest of my life with. Not perfect, he's good enough. Now you look at your wife, she may not be, you know, as beautiful as some of these supermodels, but she's good enough. If you have fault finding, then you always find fault with somebody and you won't be able to live with them. So one of those little methods to deal with that. If you're having a hard time with your relationship, or a hard time with a boyfriend you think of breaking up, get out the old sheet of paper. Draw a line down the middle of that sheet of paper. For the name of your boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, whichever it is, put their name on the top, and on the left side draw a line vertically down the middle, and on the left side of that line write all the reasons you don't like that person, all the faults in your husband or wife or boyfriend, girlfriend. Write down all their faults on the left hand side, especially when you're angry. And then on the right hand side write down all the reasons you respect them and care for them, all their wonderful qualities. Write those down too. And only when you fill both halves of the sheet of paper have you really been fair to them. And then turn the paper down the middle along the line. And the left half of that piece of paper, all the things you don't like in your husband, all the things you don't like in your wife, throw that in the waste bin. And keep the piece of paper on the right hand side, all the things you admire and respect in the person you've chosen to be with. And focus on that. And that will improve your relationship, because relationships start to founder when we only have a fault finding mind. And all we do is see the faults in the person that is with. This little method, yeah, acknowledges they have faults, but also forces you to acknowledge they all have beautiful, wonderful qualities as well. And then even have a wonderful relationship together. But you keep focusing on the good qualities. And number two, whatever you see in your partner is what they show you back. I said that before. If you focus on their faults, they will show those faults to you more and more and more. If you tell your husband he's lazy, you'll find he gets even more lazy. If you tell your wife that she's sloppy in the way she dresses, then she becomes even more sloppy. So the way to do it is to tell her she's beautiful, and she becomes more beautiful. Tell her he is a good provider, and he provides even more. This is basic psychology. If you live in a fault-finding world, the world gets worse. You make more faults. If you live in a world of gratitude, seeing people's good qualities, praising each other, respecting each other, then the world becomes a more respectful, happy place. But please do that. Respect each other in a relationship. And then you have a wonderful, happy time. So that's actually how you can use some of the wisdom of this meditation, because in meditation you let go of the fault-finding mind. Instead you develop this wonderful mind of peace and acceptance, letting things be, and you find it gets better and better and better. So where you find the treasure is right where you are. With the wife you've already got, with the husband you've already got, with the kids you've already got, there you find the treasure. You don't have to change it, you don't have to do anything different. Your kids, please don't try and exchange them. It would be a wonderful thing if we had a kid exchange in Singapore. So if you're fed up with your kids, you can exchange for some other people's kids. They do that with husbands, apparently, the husband swapping and wife swapping. But wouldn't it be good to have kids swapping? Somebody think, maybe that's an interesting idea. I could consider that. Especially when your kids are driving you around the bend. But yeah, they'll give you a lot of happiness as well. But don't be fault finding with your kids. They're brilliant, they're wonderful, they're part of you, they're your family. So tell them that, how much you love them. When you see the good in the kids show you it back. If you see the faults all the time, your kids will show you more faults. Whatever you see in other people is what they show you back. Any questions about that? We've got a few questions in here, so I'll do this one. Venerable sir! You advise us to be always in the present moment. What if the present moment is a miserable one? Is it wrong to dwell in past wonderful moments? When you may first come to the present moment, it may look miserable. But after a while, you just stay there. And it gets more and more wonderful. It's like it transforms. There's an old fairy tale about the princess. And this princess was turned into a frog by a wicked witch. And this frog was really a beautiful princess. And one day this man came, he was a handsome prince, and he kissed that frog, and the frog turned into this beautiful princess, and they lived happily ever after. You've heard that fairy tale? You know what it means? Your husband is like ugly frog. But you give him a kiss of compassion and wisdom, and then he turns into this handsome prince. This is a kiss. It's a symbol of loving kindness and of wisdom. And whatever you give loving kindness and wisdom to, however miserable it is, it turns into the most beautiful prince or princesses. So this present moment is a miserable one, just because a spell has been put on this present moment by that wicked witch called Mara. And all you need to do is to give this present moment a kiss. A kiss with loving kindness and wisdom. Present moment, you're very miserable and ugly, but I love you. And then the present moment turns into this beautiful prince or princess. It appears to be wonderful and joyful. That is how it works. But if you're negative to this present moment, the present moment is like an ugly, warty frog. But if you give this present moment a kiss of kindness, embrace it, it turns magically into a beautiful moment of peace and happiness. So it's what you add to the present moment is what's important. If you have fault finding and negative, this is miserable. I'm tired. I'm sick. I hate this moment. There you're adding negativity and you turn even princesses into frogs. Your fault, not the present moment's fault. But if you look at the present moment and give it lots of kisses, no matter how ugly the frog is at the now, it turns into the most beautiful and wonderful present moment. So you fall in love with the present moment and you live happily ever after. So that's actually how it works. If you're having a hard time, pain or whatever, that's ugly frog. Give it loving kindness. Give it the kiss of loving kindness. And it turns into a beautiful princess. Or a beautiful prince. Depends whether you're male or female or whether you're gay. Come on, laugh. Your emptiness. Your most compassionate emptiness. Does one need to be celibate to get to the jhana states? I'd experienced something jhana. Oh, yo-yo jhana 2 years ago in Chennai when I was celibate for 9 days. But haven't experienced it ever since. That means you haven't experienced sex ever since. I haven't experienced jhana for 7 days. Ever since. And I'm sure if celibacy has a direct effect on jhana. For info, I've been a good boy and I'm not being involved in any sexual misconduct. Please admit, we've met a good boy. You know, basically, I mean, all adults here, and don't think, oh, my kids are here, you mustn't mention the SEX word. They hear about it at school, they hear about it in the movies, so you might as well tell it to them now and be open and honest. They probably know much more about it than you ever expect. So the point is, my first experience of deep meditation was about 4 or 5 days after having sex with my girlfriend. And I really couldn't believe that, because I didn't know anything about Buddhism at the time. And so it was really weird and strange. But there it was, it happened. So after that, you know, the personal experience, you know, celibacy might help, but it's not absolutely necessary. So you can still get jhanas when you're having a full sex life. If you have lots and lots of lust all the time, then, you know, it's very difficult to get to jhanas because, you know, you've got too much attachment, too much craving. But yeah, it can be done. So it wasn't actually the celibacy in Chiang Mai which got you into the nice meditation. It was something else. It was just the idea of letting go, of being at peace. You managed to press all the right buttons. The problem is that once a person gets into these states once, they always want it again. And that's always a big trouble. So please never want the experience back again. Want the causes to come back. Build up the causes and then the results happen. Just like the person goes home and have all these dishes to wash in the kitchen.
They say, oh, when are my dishes going to be washed? I want my dishes to be clean. I want my dishes to be clean. That's not the way to get the dishes to be clean. Instead, you think, what's the cause for clean dishes? And the answer comes, the insight comes, washing them. So you wash them. And then, hey presto, all the dishes are clean. So instead of thinking, I want jhana, I want nimittas, I want to be peaceful, I want to be enlightened. You do that, you never get jhana, you never get peaceful. I mean, what's the cause of jhanas? Letting go. So you let go, like washing dishes. And then jhanas happen. It's as simple as that. How can Ajahn Brahm answer all questions with wise answers? Can I have your wisdom? Yeah, sure. We'll auction it off to the highest bidder to raise funds for the Brahm Center in Singapore. So how is that? It'd be wonderful if you could sell wisdom. But anyway, the only thing you can sell is stupidity. People will buy that. And they'll pay a lot of money for stupidity. It's true. They bought, I don't know how much money, how many millions they pay for that book, The Secret. So buy stupidity, but you know, wisdom you can never buy. You deal with emptiness. What are some things to be mindful about if I'm in a relationship with someone who is contemplating to be a Christian? As long as I'm only contemplating it. So say, I keep on contemplating it, but you know, don't go further than that. Take her to the priest. One thing to contemplate is to tell her, look, if you become a Christian, how much does it cost? 10% of your income. That's pre-tax. So, Buddhist, 3F, much better value for money. Cheaper price, better product. If you become a Christian, you have to be really, really good to go up to heaven. You only go up to heaven once. As a Buddhist, you go up to heaven many, 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 many times. Much better deal. I mentioned the other day, Christian heaven, very boring. Buddhist heaven, Jimi Hendrix. Whatever food you like, not just ambrosia. And really nice clothes, not these old white gowns. But no, just tell her to contemplate again reason. A lot of times in some religions they say you have to leave your brain at the door. You're not allowed to question. You're not allowed to be reasonable. So never join any religion, no matter what it is, where you have to leave your brain at the door. We are not allowed to question. So that's one thing to contemplate. Next question. Do I jump on? I am brought up a Catholic and in a mission school. Over the years I've been fairly drawn to Buddhism, yet find it hard to make the shift because in times of distress my condition to respond is still prayer. I'd appreciate your guidance on how to make the shift towards Buddhism when one is somewhat unconsciously rooted in Christianity. Yeah, well, I was baptized in a church when I was young, but I never gave my approval. I was only about 4 or 5 weeks old. No one asked me at the time. And you were exposed to Christianity, which is wonderful. If exposed to many different paths and religions, that just makes you more of a full person. You know exactly what you're doing. Another thing which I must mention, that many people who become monks at a very young age, who had not much experience of life. But I was very happy. I had girlfriends. I had actually experienced a lot of the world before I became a monk. And that's really important, simply because you know exactly what you're giving up. You had relationships, long-term relationships with girlfriends. So at least now I had some experience, I knew what I was giving up. For some poor monks and nuns, they never had any relationships much at all. They never had any sex or whatever, which means that there's something in their mind, they don't really know what they're giving up. There's always this thing in the back of their mind, ooh, maybe I've given up something which I shouldn't have given up. They don't know what they're really talking about. It's very wonderful having some experience before you have become a monk. It makes you much fuller. And the same as if you've been a Christian before, or Muslim, whatever, it gives you much more richness of experience. So you never lose anything. So you are a Catholic, brought up in a Catholic mission school, great. Please always respect that, and respect the goodness in that tradition. But if you want to be a Buddhist, wonderful. You can be a Buddhist with Christian roots. Why not? Which means that many of the things which you learnt as a kid, many of the kindnesses in Christianity, which is what it's very strong on, you know, really getting out there and helping other people, the sense of community, we can learn from that, which is a wonderful thing we're doing. But it's also a case of learning how to be a good person. And one of the things which many people say, this is not really to do with meditation, but to do with Buddhism in general in our modern world. One of the things which Buddha has never really been is politically and socially active. Well, the Christians have done that. They've actually, you know, stood up against things like slavery. They've actually, you know, suffered as a result of some of the discrimination which was there in society. Not all of them. Some of them actually defended that discrimination. But there's always been a few that actually stood up and changed the world. But not many Buddhists have done that. I remember reading this article of a speech given by Professor Richard Gombrich, the head of the Buddhist Studies Department in Oxford University. He said that was one of the big failings of Buddhism in Asia. There is a death penalty in Thailand, and no monks stand up against that. Okay, that's un-Buddhist to have a death penalty in your legal system. You don't have that death penalty in modern Christian democracies in Europe. We still have it in the United States, but not in Europe, because people have stood up against that. It's not being a deterrent, not working, being inhuman, against human rights. Why don't the Buddhists stand up against that? In Thailand, and in Singapore, and in, well, Malaysia is not a Buddhist country, and in Sri Lanka. There's still a death penalty in Sri Lanka, they still hang people there apparently. So those are the sorts of things which some Buddhists actually should stand up for. Even if it means they lose their privileges, even if it means sometimes they're put in jail for it. That sort of leadership is something which the Christians have been strong at, the Buddhists have been very weak at. But it's a fair criticism. So when I get criticized for that, and I say, well, actually, you're right then, I'll try to do something about it. So, and that's also one of the reasons why people don't respect Buddhism so much. They think it's soft. It's got a wonderful message, spiritually brilliant. And all the truths they give, all the meditation, the kindness, compassion, is better than any other religion. But where are we weak as a social action? Places we're not really relevant. So Buddhism is a very private path, seen by many people. We really should do a bit more than that. That's how I feel anyway. I don't know if you feel the same. But it's got a lot to offer, we should offer it. Get out of that, I prefer to do walking meditation, as I often find myself falling asleep during city meditation. Worse still, I'm afraid I'll snore. Actually, you only usually snore when actually leaning back. If you're sitting, you don't usually snore. But anyway, if you do snore, remember what I told other people. Don't disturb the noise, because it's not the noise which disturbs you. So it's not the snoring disturbs other people, it's they who disturb your snoring. It's just nature, so just snore. Is walking meditation as effective as sitting meditation? Yeah, it can be almost as effective. You can't get into jhana when you're walking meditation. You can certainly get very peaceful and very still. And especially if you do walking meditation, you get still enough to overcome all that sleepiness. So then when you do sit meditation, you don't have that problem of falling asleep. So do walking meditation first. And then afterwards do sitting meditation, you find you don't go to sleep. You don't snore. And that's a wonderful way of doing your meditation. So any other comments on those questions before we do another meditation? So we can do another meditation. Now let's do some snoring meditation. So if you want to, you okay, if you want to stand up and just stretch your legs, please do so. Otherwise, for some of you who are leaving this afternoon, this is the last chance for Nibbana, the last chance for jhana. Oh, who knows what's going to happen in the next 25 minutes? So here we go. Now today we're going to do bliss meditation.
Those of you into ecstasy and can't afford the pills, which are illegal anyway, bad for your health. This is the alternative to the drug ecstasy. This is the meditation ecstasy. And those of you who want to piss out, here we come. So first of all, have a feel. How does your body feel now? Is there happiness in the body or suffering? See if you can move your body to a greater degree of happiness. So instead of making stillness your goal, is happiness in the body. And if there's an obstacle to happiness, such as, you know, your legs are too tight, or something's pressing against the other, see if you can adjust your body, adjust your legs. See if you can notice when your body gets in a good position, not only is it relaxed, but it feels pleasure. The pleasure of a comfortable body. So once you have adjusted your body so far, now please look in your body. What's the most pleasurable part of your body right now? What's the part that feels the nicest? Which feels the most peaceful? The one which is so comfortable. What does that feel like? So we're not going to the thoughts in the body. We go to the other part of the body, which is not tight, which is not tense. The part which is at ease and comfortable and free. Sometimes people are sick from the cancer. Sometimes they forget the cancer is only a part of their body. And the rest gets neglected. You may have an ache or pain in one place. What about the rest of your body? Until you start to feel this delightful pleasure of bodily relaxation. It's one of the reasons why you go to the spa for a foot massage or a back massage. It's so pleasurable to be relaxed. Once the body is nicely at ease, then focus on your mental world. In this present moment, it's the most pleasurable place to be. In the past, there's so much work to be done. In the future, there's so many worries and uncertainties. So see if you can perceive the pleasure of now. Not having to do anything, not having to go anywhere. The pleasure of resting. The pleasure of not having to achieve things. Not having to be forced, just being free to be. You can experience the pleasure of that freedom. The freedom from desire. So content in this moment, you don't need anything.
just the pleasure of not having to think, not having to form a demon, not having to work anything out. It's the pleasure of being free from this noise called thinking. Breathe in. Breathe the most pleasant, beautiful, even sensuous impact you can possibly make on purpose. Breathe in with joy, with pleasure. If you breathe out the most delightful breath, full of joy and happiness. Breathe in joy. Breathing out happiness. Here you can start noticing the pleasure of peace. The rightful breath going in. The rightful breath going out. Only a specific type of pleasure, joy and happiness of meditation. Once you start to notice that pleasure, it will grow and go through into ecstasy. please watch the wondrous path and discipline we have from now to now. Remember this verse and the first commandments.